From the heart of the Forest City, Blackburn Media presents the Craig Needles Podcast, looking at the biggest stories in London and around the world and how they impact you. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
Another new episode of the Craig Needles Podcast here on a Friday. Thank you very much for downloading and listening, whichever platform you're on, be it on londonnewstoday.ca or classicrock981.com. And the big story that everyone's thinking about right now, that a lot of people are talking about, is getting back to school, which is what's going to happen on Monday. In-person learning returns. There is an announcement made by the Education Minister, Stephen Lecce, to help me break down what everyone's looking at and what we're thinking about heading into that. We are joined by Craig Smith, who, of course, is the president of the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario here in Thames Valley, and joins us here on the Craig Needles Podcast for the first time. Craig, thank you very much for doing this. Glad you could do it.
Thank you, Craig.
So we're going back on Monday. We got the official announcement on Wednesday, but we've kind of had an inkling for about a week here, the entirety of this week, that this is going to happen. How are you and how are teachers in our area feeling about this as we get closer to here?
I think there'll be a range of emotions at this point. I mean, overall, I think teachers want to be back at school with the students. That's the place where the teaching and the learning happens best. The caution has always been, and the question has always been, is it safe to do so? And by that, I mean, are there measures in place that will not only allow schools to reopen, but will allow teachers and students to remain at school safely? And I think that's where there has been some questions, which lead to sort of the other feelings of apprehension, and I would say in some cases some fear, given the transmissibility of the Omicron variant and the fact that it does not discriminate between those who are vaccinated and those who are not, and recognizing that the overwhelming number of students still in the elementary panel are not vaccinated. It's created some real concern and apprehension as we do the thing that we have gotten used to doing during the pandemic, which is the pivot from one learning model to another.
And yeah, that's something that's happened pretty regularly. And I know that I've talked with the teachers at my daughter's school, and they said, yeah, we're going to be able to figure this out. We're going to go back and forth. We've done it before. We can do it again. So I understand that is going to be a little bit difficult for teachers. I understand that some teachers may not necessarily love the idea of going back, but some I would suspect are pretty happy to go back, right? Like you said, it's a mix.
The challenge, you know, teachers will do what they need to do in terms of teaching and the learning and support of the learning of the students, whether that's face-to-face or in a virtual setting. The challenge with the virtual setting is it's a very different approach to teaching. And frankly, you know, as a parent, you'll know that it's a very different approach to learning for the students. And none of it is ideal, but it is the option, an option that we have at this point. The transition between the virtual platform to the face-to-face or vice versa isn't as easy as people might think. It's a really different model. And so you have to package the things that you're teaching the kids somewhat differently. That said, you know, we have had these pivots over the course of the pandemic. I think the big gamble right now is to ensure that the schools remain open. And that will be the measure, I think, of the success, quote unquote, of the government's plan at this point. It will be if the schools can stay open and stay open safely. The other part of that, though, is that it isn't as clean or as full a return as we might think. There are a number of options, both short term and long term, that are being presented to parents that will allow them to keep their kids from school. And that's a concern as well, because if the schools were as safe as the Minister of Education would have us believe, and other people who chime in on this, then why are those options even there in the first place? So, you know, there is a question about what this return to face-to-face learning will actually look like. And we won't know the beginning of that until Monday itself.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's some questions that teachers have as to how many students they're going to actually see on Monday.
That will be telling. Because we know that there are options for next week for, you know, that we know that, that there will be parents who are concerned who will simply, you know, have their kids absent from school, you know, for next week as or the next couple of weeks as they see how things play out. I really do think it's going to be the focus of the classroom teachers now, of the teachers in the schools, will be to focus on the students who are in front of them, not only for the teaching pieces, but to ensure that the health and safety protocols, such as they are adhered to, the masking requirements and all the rest that are adhered to. And we'll also see how things play out. I know great hay has been made of cohorting. And I don't know why they just don't simply call it a class, because cohorting creates the idea that there are these bubbles in the school, which they just aren't. There is no cohorting that really happens in the schools. And so that's a risk, especially against the backdrop of a variant that is very easily transmissible. So, you know, we'll wait and see. I think Monday we'll start to see how that is playing out and the effect that it has on the ability of schools to stay open.
Do teachers in Thames Valley have a safe workspace right now, or a workspace that you feel is I guess, safe enough to go to? I know that COVID transmission is not going to be zero, but are you comfortable with the fact that they are going back on Monday?
Well, there are some things that have been, you know, announced and suggested that aren't exactly, you know, true, if we can just be blunt about it. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the Minister of Education makes a great announcement about, you know, HEPA filters being put into the schools. And it was initial deployment in the fall of 70,000 of those. And then at the Christmas break, there was announced there was another 3,000 coming in to the system. You know, so that additional 3,000 means that Thames Valley essentially received 0.3 of a HEPA filter per school. So they've created this idea, or this visual, that every classroom, if it doesn't have mechanical ventilation, keeping the school clean and ventilated in that regard, that every classroom has a HEPA filter in it doing that job. And that simply is not true. We know that they've been prioritized for classrooms that would have some of our more vulnerable students in spec ed environments and other related classrooms. So this idea that the air is being ventilated either on a mechanical school-wide basis or classroom by classroom is just not true. The other piece, you know, EDFO as a union has been advocating for N95 masks for teachers for about a year and a half since the beginning of all of this. And the government has finally seen fit to provide those as an option for teachers. That may lend another layer of comfort or confidence for teachers, but at the same time, they're not being required. So there's lots of gaps, and I think it's those gaps that haven't really been answered, either for, you know, teachers who work in the schools or for the parents of the kids who are in the schools too. There are some gaps that need to be closed before I think we could say in confidence, yeah, I think we're as safe as we could be.
Yeah, I understand that that element to it. Now, I've seen some people online and whatnot speculate about, can teachers take a work action here because the workspace is not safe enough? Is that something that's been talked about or considered with Elementary Teachers Federation, if not this week, other points during the pandemic?
Well, there's two parts to that. The first is the direction that's been given by the Chief Medical Officer of Health and reiterated by the Director of Education in Thames Valley about how teachers and how students are to respond if they're symptomatic. So the first part of that being that, you know, if a teacher, for example, has any one of the symptoms, and we have to do a daily declaration of that before we can go to work and pass that. If we have any one of those, one or more of those symptoms, then we are required by order of the Chief Medical Officer of Health, which has been reiterated by the Medical Officer of Health in this district and reiterated by the director, we must be absent from school and isolate for a period of between 5 and 10 days. That means that the teacher, you know, plans for one day of work, then they are in quarantine for that period of time until they feel that they are no longer symptomatic so they can come back to work. There's no testing at this point to declare that. So you can see where that's going to create a challenge. We will have teachers away because they are dealing with symptoms of Omicron. And there will be very few, we think, occasional teachers to replace them. That is going to create a challenge in the operation of the schools and the classrooms. And we also know that the government has offloaded the responsibility for closing schools and classrooms to the board almost exclusively. So, you know, it is a question of a 30% threshold for absences. And if they're at that 30%, then the school would You know, they have, the board has to make a decision whether they're going to keep the school open or not. So a lot of those big decisions that were made by the government and the ministry are now being offloaded to the board, teachers, and parents. And that's going to be a challenge as we move forward through all of this to see if how long it lasts, if it can in fact be sustainable.
Yeah, and we've seen other jurisdictions the numbers have not been good, so we're just going to have to look. But I think back to what the science table has said, and they say this is the right move because in-person learning, as far as what we hope we're going to have, is better than online learning. I know that the acting medical officer of health said that to me yesterday when I asked him if he thought this was the right move. He said he very much supports schools being open. So there's that part of the conversation as well. How much does that weigh into your considerations here that these medical experts are saying, hey, this is the right thing to do?
Well, I mean, I think the important piece here is to understand that we all want to be at school. And I think teachers get a little tired of hearing this as a reminder. We get it. Mm-hmm. And we've been very clear that that's where we want to be too. But there are some expectations that I think we have, both on behalf in our own interest, but in the interest of the students that we teach, because our working conditions and the learning conditions of the students are identical. So in that regard, the ongoing sort of lecture about, the importance, we get that. Just as it's important for someone who's sick to be able to see their doctor face to face, you know, we get the importance of that too. So I don't discount that. I think the issue with teachers is we're forever dealing with disruption and lag and gaps in student learning. And this is just the nature of what the work that we do. And so to put one above the other, I think to me creates a bit of a false choice. It isn't a question of either or, it needs to be both in terms of the mental health pieces for kids and for their ability to learn. I mean, we're still in a pandemic, and that's going to affect how things operate. And there seems to be some hope and wishful thinking that we weren't. And that seems to have infected the science table a bit. They seem to have gotten to this idea that, well, we're done with this and we're kind of moving through and then we need to get back to normal. Well, we're not there yet. And I think that's the other piece. A previous question that you did ask, I just wanted to circle back to the work refusal. So teachers do, as workers, have the right to refuse unsafe work. Ours is a limited right because we have a duty of care to the students in front of us. So it has to be imminent threat, and we have to make sure that the students themselves are taken care of first before we can refuse work. But there is that possibility, and teachers as workers under the Occupational Health and Safety Act would have to make that determination on their own. It isn't something that the union can counsel or that we can encourage on a mass scale. That does not mean, however, that if a teacher declares for whatever reason that they feel unsafe at work, that we would not provide the required support for that teacher. It's just, it can't be done on a mass scale. It's an individual worker that would determine that in their individual context, and that their union would provide the support to them in that regard. It's one that we would caution people to use legitimately and carefully, because it could be construed as job action, and that would be a challenge under the Ontario Labour Relations Act. We can't take one action under one piece of act and then to accomplish another goal. So work refusal for sure is there as an option for teachers as workers, and that we as the union would support them in the process of the declaration if they needed that.
Right. Yeah, I get it. So it can't be just a union-wide thing. So it's just
can't be directed by the union at all.
Right.
That really is it. It is a right that a worker has under the Occupational Health and Safety Act, regardless of whether they're in a unionized environment or not.
What would you like to see? What would make you feel better about the situation? Is it just as simple as better masks, more HEPA filters? Or is there more that you'd like to see the government having done heading into Monday that perhaps they didn't?
Well, the first thing with the government, it would be nice that they actually acted on everything that they keep re-announcing. There is that piece, because there's a lot of re-announcement of things that have already been announced. And so at the end, though, nothing really changes. In fact, the difference between schools on January 17th, 2022 versus schools on December 17th, 2021 is that there isn't much difference. The Omicron numbers remain high. All of those things, haven't changed. There were large numbers of cases in schools, both staff and students. The prospect of that hasn't changed. What has changed is that there are fewer mechanisms in place in January than there were in December. So there is there isn't much by way of testing at all. There is no now requirement to report individual cases either to the system or to other parents of kids in a class to know that, okay, you might want to take some precautions, that we've got an identified case. All of that's gone. We seem to be flying into this next phase blind. And that's a real concern. So some commitment to following up on commitments that have already been made would be good. Moving forward, I think the other piece is the Omicron itself and the numbers. They're still high. And we have not yet, I think, gotten a handle on lowering those to keep schools safe. There seems to be this notion that schools are a magical place where Omicron really doesn't do its business. And it does. I mean, schools are very much a reflection of the community. And yes, they are structured, highly structured environments, but they're highly structured environments with periods of organized and supervised chaos, particularly recess and activities on the yard, where students are out and about, and also at lunchtime, where they are in close contact eating. And so there are some key parts of the structure of the school day that make students vulnerable and make staff vulnerable. So I think some further commitments to doing the things that have already been promised would be helpful. We haven't seen much action on that yet. Right now we're a wing and a prayer and a bit of hope, but hope is never a strategy. And although we hope that we're able to kind of weather this smoothly, I think, we may see some bumpy days ahead.
Has the booster, the vaccine, been available enough for teachers? I know that Dr. Summers talked about that on his media update yesterday.
So the special access for teachers, we had been asking if there was some consideration for preferred access for teachers and other education workers because of the environment we work in. That was proceeded with in the Greater Toronto area, but not in any great here. It just wasn't offered here. I will say that teachers, elementary teachers in particular in Thames Valley, were quick to access vaccines as they were available, to the point now where 97% of elementary teachers in Thames Valley are fully vaccinated. That's the highest rate of vaccination of any employee group in Thames Valley. It's also among the highest rates of vaccination of any group within the province. So teachers voted with their feet in that regard, and I think are accessing boosters as they're available. So that piece is in place. As I said, though, that's a good thing, I think, in terms of the long-term impact that COVID has on people if they contract it. But that's the point. Both the vaccinated and the unvaccinated, or the partially vaccinated, are vulnerable to this variant because it doesn't discriminate. And so that's why I think vaccinations have been well received here, teachers. And if it were left to us alone, I think we would have ended COVID-19. But sadly, we're not alone in all of that. But we're doing our bit, and teachers continue to do their bit in that regard. I think that's some level of comfort and confidence for them. But we know it's no insurance policy against actually contracting this.
It's an insurance policy against like the extreme symptoms, of course, as we all agree. But as far as getting it, it may or may not be of assistance to you.
The challenge, I think, again, is given the age of the students in our care, that the vaccination rates are what they are. They aren't 100% at all,
of course,
and even in the elementary panel, you know, the idea of a student having both boosters is still relatively small, I think, to the overall number of students that we teach. So, you know, that's a concern. Again, a question that, you know, the ministry hasn't really answered is why they haven't made vaccinations mandatory for students. And we know that there is a long history of vaccination of students in this province. There's legislation that's been tested and found to be perfectly valid and legal with regards to that. A simple amendment to that act would allow vaccination to be done on a mandatory basis for students. The government hasn't proceeded with that. So we're left to encouraging. You know, we certainly want to see everyone who makes the choice to be vaccinated under this framework that they do so, because that will help keep more people safe.
Yeah, I hope the very same thing. Is there anything else that you wanted to get into or talk about for our audience here, Craig, before we wrap up our conversation?
No, the opportunity to continue to have conversations about this is really important. I think the thing that is most concerning about all of this is that the government itself seems to have given up the fight against COVID, that it's no longer being seen as a public health emergency or a public health issue that can be managed through public health. Government seems to have thrown up its hands and thrown in the towel on that, and that their focus has now shifted to COVID-19 as an economic problem that needs to be gotten through. So this idea that they're still listening to science, but they're listening to economic science, which is the slim science, is deeply troubling. I mean, and the step from that is simply this, that it seems to be that there is this hope that we'll get through it, and that, you know, high levels of infection, but, you know, this month and next month will give us a nice spring and summer. Well, that's getting dangerously close to the idea of herd immunity. And I'm not sure there is herd immunity with this. And if that is the mindset that has been taken by this government, then they're putting an awful lot of people. There are 2 million students in this province. And their parents and caregivers. Add to that the teachers and other education workers. That's a significant portion of the population that are directly connected to schools as congregated settings where this thing can flare up again. And it worries me a little bit that seems to be the mindset. Less a public health issue, more an economic problem. And a lot of people are vulnerable as a result of where they're going at this point.
Yeah, I guess we're gonna have to see. It's just gonna be a matter of finding out for a lot of us. But I do appreciate Craig, you giving us a couple of minutes here and talking about this with us as to what the learning situation is gonna be like. We'll see how many kids are around. We'll see how many teachers are around. I suppose a week from now, and I guess we'll be in touch, right?
You know where to find me, and it's always a pleasure to talk with you, Craig. And these are important issues for sure. They have and we recognize that. The conversations we have about, you know, where students are learning and how they're learning is of deep concern to everyone in the system, you know, teachers and parents and students, obviously. But we recognize that this has not been easy for parents. And I would say we know that because 60% of our members are parents with kids in the system. So they know full well the challenges that parents face who have to balance work and the decisions around the safety and learning of their kids. So, you know, it's a difficult situation for everyone, but I think you're quite right. If we continue to take care of ourselves and are mindful of each other, then hopefully we'll get through this in good order.
Thanks for this, Craig. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much, Craig.
What I'll say about the political gambit here, just the political gambit, not the health gambit, the political gambit for Ford here. And I've been saying this on Twitter. They could have made schools a safer space in June, July, August, if they needed to, if they wanted to, if they were serious about this. They got 70,000 HEPA filters, fine. That number could have been 100,000. And perhaps they're not having the same conversations today if they had taken this thing a little bit more seriously in the summer. So that's one. That's not hindsight either. There were people saying that, including people like Craig Smith. So that's one point. The other point is this. there is very credible evidence that today, yesterday, maybe the day before, somewhere in there, we reached the Omicron point, tipping point, the top of the case mountain, and we're going to see the cases continue to decline. And we've seen credible evidence of this via wastewater, via test positivity. Okay, good. If they had waited a week longer to get back to school, would it have cost them very much politically? I'm not sure. Any damage they were going to take on, they had already taken on by closing for 2 weeks. So I don't know how much it would have cost them politically. Plus, it avoids the possibility, which distinctly exists, of case counts climbing because schools get back in session and schools potentially having to be shut down again. Maybe not Ontario-wide, but in certain school boards. So there is that political risk for the Ford government. This is what they have as their cover, though. And to be clear, this is legitimate. When medical experts like Dr. Alex Summers, the people around the Ontario Science Table, including, you know, Dr. Peter Juni, who's been doing a lot of media about this, and I've been trying to get some science people to come chat with me about this. No such luck yet. We'll get there. Hopefully soon. They have said, hey, look, we think that having school open is the right thing. It is the least bad of multiple bad options has essentially been the take that I've seen. Not universal, to be clear, but that's a take that I've seen. And I agree with that. It's the least bad of several bad options. Well, at the very least, I'm willing to acknowledge that that is a reasonable person's take. So they have that. I don't know if cover is the right word, but they have that as part of the conversation that medical experts have said, hey, school being open is the right thing. We'll see what happens. We will see how this unfolds. But the one thing that I wanted to be clear about here before we move on to a completely other different subject in just a second is I don't think it's fair for anyone to say there's a universal opinion amongst the leading medical experts here that opening schools is the right call or keeping schools closed is the right call here in Ontario this coming week. I don't think that exists. Whereas with previous school closures, that did exist. It was pretty much universal. Yeah, these things got to shut down. At least for in person. This is a different type of conversation. You may not agree with opening schools, but you have to acknowledge that the discourse from people who are pretty smart is different now than it has been before. So as I said to Craig Smith and as I said to everybody, let's just sit here and hope for the best. I understand there's going to be some stress, though. I get that. I acknowledge that. And hey, if you want to keep your kid at home this week, I don't think anyone should have anything negative to say about that. And if you want to send your kid to school this week, same deal. I really feel that way. It can be up to the individual here. So if you want your kid to go, okay. If you want to keep your kid home, also okay. Let's pause quickly because I'm going to talk about something completely separate on the other side of a very quick break here. You're listening to the Craig Needles podcast on LondonNewsToday.ca and on ClassicRock981.com. If you've been with me for a while, say since April 2018 as an example, if you've listened to things that I've done in the audio forum on Twitter and whatnot, you might remember this story. This is from April of 2018, as I said. Dave Warren came on the talk show with me when I was working at the other place and discussed his wife's care. With her permission, I went and had a conversation with his wife after she got out of the hospital about the whole thing. At the London Health Science Center. And it was, quite frankly, not an acceptable level of care, and I don't think anyone should classify it as such. She basically spent nearly a week in a hallway. And this is from the show that I did. This is in April of 2018, back when I was at Corus Entertainment. Just paint the picture for us as to what that is like. And I know you said there are other people in beds that are right nearby, right along the same wall. Just tell us more about what that's like when she's in that situation.
Well, when you have a busy hospital, busy emergency room, people running in and out of the radiology department, guards, nurses, doctors, you know, people that are working and whatever, and it's hectic. People are yelling. People are whatever, you know, it's just it's total chaos. And for somebody who's anxious and depressed, what they need most of all is a nice, quiet place to rest and recover. That is absolutely not the ideal place to be. And then to sit for 120 hours, I understand the system's, you know, stressed. I understand, the logistics, and I understand all the stuff that the hospital officials will say. But this, to me, is inhuman. It's a violation of human rights, basic human rights and dignity. And, you know, it's not helping the patients. It's actually hurting them.
It's making it worse.
Yeah, and making the recovery time for them that much longer.
That's the part that, well, there's a lot of this really, really angers me. And that's certainly one of the things is we have hospitals in place to help people get better. And this is making situations worse. And further to that, like you said, how is anyone supposed to get better when they have almost no privacy? There's all sorts of people around them. They don't know who's going to be going in and out of that particular hallway. It's a high traffic area. So the idea that, oh, yeah, this is where you're going to get better. I know there's short rooms, there's short staff, whatever it happens to be. But it's just not even close to being acceptable. And I think that we as a province, as a collective, should be embarrassed by the fact that people are going through that situation, not just your wife, but anyone else who's been in that spot. And we've been hearing about this for years. Oh, yeah, this is something that happens. And we always hear it's going to get fixed. It's going to get fixed. It's going to get fixed. But as we've seen by the story you're just telling us, it clearly hasn't.
So that was Dave Warren and I talking about the care that his wife received at One Health Science Center. There was a big, long conversation, multiple segments. Dave was on a few different times talking about mental health in the community and mental health care at the hospital. Well, I have a sad update to pass along about that story. Don Warren, a few weeks ago, it was in November, took her own life, sadly. The mental health issues that she was dealing with, they, much like often happens in these cases, they go away, they come back, they go away, they come back. And in this case, they came back and she was having a tough time, and sadly, she's not with us anymore. And it's heartbreaking stuff. And I wanted to talk to Dave Warren about that. And I kind of reached out to him after Donna passed away. And I sort of said, hey, I'm sorry about what went on here. I'm thinking about you. Anything you need me to do, you let me know. And Dave said, hey, can we have a chat on the podcast about it, you know, when I'm ready? And I said, yeah, Dave, of course, whenever you'd like. So I bring Dave on now to talk about Don, talk about what he's learned about the mental health system as he's sort of navigated all this. And he joins us here on the Craig Needles podcast to discuss that today. Dave, thank you so much for this. We appreciate it.
No, well, thank you for having me. We'll try and get through this as best as we can.
Yeah, it's hard, and I know it's hard. Let's just first start by talking about, you know, you came on the radio show and we talked about sort of what had gone on, and there are some people on the Health Science Center who are not necessarily thrilled with me or with you for the way that it went down, and that's kind of in the past now. We don't have to necessarily go over that too much again. We sort of both know the story, and anyone who listened may know the story, but what sort of happened sort of in the years between that and the end of Don's life? Sort of what was the navigation through the system like for you?
Well, she had been going to a DBT group, dialectical behavioral therapy, which is supposedly it's to get people to change the way they think. And so for about a year, I guess, before COVID hit, because it was 2018 when she got it in, she was in the hospital, and then, you know, and then COVID hit 2020. So between that time, she was going regularly to groups and she was seeing her psychiatrist and whatnot. And she's, you know, she kind of seemed to be getting better, but then COVID hit. And the isolation just kind of looked like it crushed her. She couldn't see doctors. You couldn't see your shrink. The group shut down, and they all said, oh, well, it's because of COVID, but you could still stick four people in a room spaced out, you know, 6 feet apart or more. And so, you know, to me, it just kind of seemed like a sham. So gradually, she just kept getting, just, you know, went down the rabbit hole. And eventually on November 19th, she couldn't take it anymore. And I woke up and kind of found her not responsive, and then had to call the emergency services. And by 10 p.m., 10, 11, November 19th, she was gone.
I'm so sorry to hear that. She was a lovely person. I really enjoyed the fact that I got a chance to meet her. And I feel awful that this is sort of the way it went. And look, COVID has been a challenge for a lot of people. I shouldn't even say a lot of people. It's been a challenge for literally every single person on this planet in some way, shape, or form. It's been challenging. It's been difficult. But those who have been dealing with mental health concerns, mental health issues, it's been a different type of challenge for them. And it was a different type of challenge for Dawn and for you and for your family. And that's just hard to hear. And you're right. There could have been ways to work around that may have helped her. And maybe they would have, maybe they wouldn't have. But the fact that we sit here and we don't know, I'm sure, is a little bit frustrating for you.
Yeah, it's... The only thing I want to do at this point is make sure that nobody else has to go through this. I just want people to know that there are alternatives to the mainstream that everybody is thinking about. And that's what I want to get out there. Things like psychedelics and ketamine, along with traditional psychotherapy, can actually resolve issues of suicidal thinking. But with COVID and getting all the spotlight, these things have kind of been pushed to the back burner because, well, it was a 15-year struggle. So,
well, there's a lot to consider.
It's not my fault, but it's just sad that everything seems to have conspired to end the story this way.
No, it's heartbreaking. It's absolutely awful. What do you wish was different? Because you mentioned the way that you sort of had to navigate this and, hey, wait, what about this treatment here? Wait, what about that treatment here? It feels as though, and maybe I'm being overly simplistic, but it feels as though there might be a way to streamline this for families. And I know that the same therapies are not going to work for everybody. I know it's not saying this is a one-size-fits-all solution to this stuff here, but it feels like there are ways that we could have done this for Dawn and for others that could have made navigating all of this stuff a lot easier, especially during COVID.
So what you need to do is to become your own advocate, and you have to go online. Like, treatments, like you said, there's nothing specific. So maybe that's what we need to do, is to just, you know, get all the information, get it all together, put it in a central repository and say, here. I had to say, look, no, sorry, we're not using that treatment. This is the one that worked. This is the one we have. But at this point, you have to be your own advocate, which to me is ridiculous. Like in emergency, they're just not equipped to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. And that was the frustrating part when Dawn was in the hospital a previous time, was, you know, you go to the emergency room because that's where you go if there's an emergency, and then they just kind of stick her in that hallway for days on end. And look, is that the fault of the people that were in the emergency room that particular day? No, but it was very much a sign of the decay of our system, which has become a back burner thing during COVID-19 because the system's dealing with another crisis. So it's just, it's hard to think, but it's probably true that we're probably even in worse off shape now than we were when all that was going on, right?
And as you know, they made the hallway medicine policy right after, mm-hmm. So we couldn't sue them. Although I will say, with my father-in-law, he's actually getting excellent care. He had pneumonia. He had surgery where he had to have two tumors removed from his back. I can say with, you know, 100% certainty, he's getting the absolute best treatment he can. and he's actually in a better place right now. He's been in the hospital for over a week. But once again, that's physical illness. People with mental illness are not getting the best they can, because I just don't think the system is set up to help. I think it's just all about, you know, maintaining. It's less about curing and helping people recover, and more about just maintaining the status quo. And until we turn that around and make it a priority of mental health medicine to actually be medicine instead of, you know, what it is right now, which is just treat symptoms. It's not treat the disease, it's treat symptoms. And that's the biggest problem with mental health.
Yeah, and you know what? It's a society-wide thing, Dave, because it's not just at the hospital level. But right now, and this is something that needs some significant reform and all over the place, but right now, if someone is having a mental health crisis, if they call 911, who shows up? In a lot of cases, it's going to be the police. And,
first, yeah.
And here's the thing. I don't blame police officers for this. Police officers themselves would tell you that, hey, this is not something we want to be on our plate, but the police are not the people that should be showing up for this. And I'm not blaming individual officers for that. I'm not even blaming police services as a whole for that. I'm blaming the government for the fact that, yeah, okay, so we don't have an emergency mental health crisis team that can handle this stuff, as opposed to police officers who are, in most cases, are not going to be trained in this sort of thing. Like, it just shows a societal disconnect from what people who may be in a mental health crisis are going to need. If we're saying, oh yeah, we'll just send the cops over there, problem solved. Sorry, that's not going to solve the problem.
The one thing I will say about the three police officers that showed up when I called, they were extremely professional, very, very helpful, very caring, compassionate. So, yeah, they're put between a rock and a hard place. And yeah, why can't we have a certain that kind of sounds cool, like a mental health response team.
Yeah.
Or
a crisis team or whatever you want to call it. Like, and there's ways we can do this, and this will require training professionals and things along those lines. But it's the heck of a lot better for literally everyone than the police having to do this. The police don't want to go to this. The police are not trained in this. And the police are far less equipped to help in these situations. So let's, you know, so it just shows to me that society is prioritizing the wrong things here when we come to at-home crisis response, when it comes to someone who's going to the ER, when it comes to someone who might be recovering from this sort of thing. You mentioned that these groups sort of faded in and out with COVID because of, you know, limits on who can be in the same room and things along those lines. It just shows that the priorities are completely out of whack here, in my estimation.
Yeah, sadly, they are. And I think even the whole entire medical system, you know, it's like, you got a headache, take an Advil. It's not what caused the headache or what, you know, what causes. Mm-hmm. We're not even looking really at what causes mental illness. We're just like, okay, you have a chemical imbalance, and they haven't even proved it yet. And that's the thing that bugs me the most, is they don't, you know, they go off with their hypothesis and then, you know, they run with it. And now it's all of a sudden it's an accepted fact. But here's the thing. 40% of people do not respond to regular antidepressants. So 60% will, and I'm one of them. I've responded well to whatever antidepressants I've been on in my life, and I'm thankful for that, and I'm glad it helped. But what about the 40%, like my wife, who don't respond, and she became suicidal every time they tried to put her on a regular, they're called serotonin selective reuptake, da 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 da. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it now, like some of the alternatives, like I mentioned, there's mushrooms and there's ketamine, and they're now in phase two trials with the mushrooms, and there's, you know, there's been success. And the thing that, and this will explain why I'm upset. The first trials they had are on end of life people. Like, okay, I understand you're dying. I understand you're anxious about dying. But what about the living? And isn't a suicidal person kind of at the end of life stage? Like, it just burned me that Don couldn't get into a trial because she was only suicidal and right. not physically or mentally on death. Well, physically on death's door.
Yeah. So no, I get that.
She couldn't get help. She couldn't get help. And why are we starting at end of life? Why couldn't we have started at just plain old, you know, suicidal or slightly depressed or more depressed, whatever level of depression you want to get to? Like, it just didn't make any sense to me.
No, I understand that entirely. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me either. I'll ask you, Dave, before we wrap up, because we don't have a ton of time left here. What would your advice be to someone who may be in this situation right now with a spouse, with a child, with a parent, whoever it happens to be, someone who is in your spot where they're trying to advocate for someone who is going through a mental health crisis during this time of isolation, and we're in COVID and it's very difficult for everybody, but again, it's more difficult for some than others. What would your advice be to someone who is in that position right now?
If in your heart you think, and I made the mistake of going the wrong way on this one, but if you think for one moment that your loved one is going to kill themselves, then grab them, go to the doctor and get them formed, a 72-hour form, and get them in the hospital. In spite of everything I've just said about the system, it's better to be in a hallway on a gurney or up in a room for 72 hours and be alive than to have what happened with Dawn. Just do the research. Go Google. Everybody says the internet's whatever. Go to two or three different sites. Read up as much as you can. Talk to your doctor. Stick up for the person. Because here's another thing that people don't know, is kids under 18 really shouldn't be on antidepressants, because there's this little side effect called creating suicidal thoughts. And that's what the drugs do. You have to watch. Kids, adults are fine. You know, adults, we can deal with it and whatever. Kids are special. And they need to be looked after a lot differently than adults. But either way, if you have a feeling, if your gut's telling you something, listen to it. I didn't, and bad things happened.
I'm really sorry to hear that. And I like I said, my heart breaks for you and for your boys. And all the best from me going forward here. And obviously, you know my number if anything else happens or whatever else is going on, you know how to find me. Anything else that you want to leave us with, Dave, before we wrap up here?
Yes, I just want to say Craig Needles is awesome. Listen to his podcast.
He's a
true, genuine human being. And I can't say exactly how I know, but he thinks and acts outside the box, which is incredible. And for that, like I've told him before, I owe him an incredible debt of gratitude. If you have any problems and you need the system to get a good kick in the butt, give Craig Needles a call.
I appreciate that, Dave. Thank you so much for saying that. And I'm not going to exactly say what happened, but let's just say that I may have violated a rule or two, but it got results. So we'll just say that I may have violated a rule or two when Don was in the hospital, but it got some results. So.
It did. Yeah. And like I said, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Take care, Craig. We'll leave it there. Yeah, you too, Dave. Thank you so much for doing this. And like I said, I'm thinking about you. I'm thinking about the boys, okay?
Thanks, man. Take care.
That is Dave Warren here on the Craig Needles podcast. And glad that I could have a conversation with Dave. And like I said, my thoughts are definitely with him and his family right now. We've got to wrap up. So thank you very much for listening this week on londonnewstoday.ca, classicrock981.com, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you're finding us, wherever you're downloading us, please continue to do it. Having important London community conversations here on the Craig Needles Podcast. We will have more of those next week.
The Craig Needles Podcast is a presentation of Blackburn Media.